And welcome back to the second half of Earth First Radio. I'm Uncle Dennis, and there's more important information coming up, so please keep that pencil and paper handy. Let's get right on into this week's commentary. National forest logging costs outweigh their benefits. The logging program on America's national forests cannot be justified on economic grounds because it does more harm than good, two environmental groups have said. Their report, The Economic Case Against National Forest Logging, argues that cutting down the national forest is a money-losing proposition, and that standing trees provide ecosystem functions that are much more valuable than their wood alone. National forests represent just 19% of all timberland in the United States, and timber from these lands supports less than 5% of the nation's annual wood products consumption. The wood products industry, heavily subsidized by the federal government, is shrinking. In 1998, for example, the U.S. Forest Service was able to sell only 22% of the timber that was put on the auction block in Alaska. The 75-page report, the result of 3 years of research, analyzes the economic value of ecosystem services provided by standing forests, including flood control, water purification, pest control, and pollination. These services, the report argues, contribute many times more economic value to rural communities than logging. National forests are far more valuable to America's rural communities, standing and growing as living ecosystems, than they are chopped down and turned into 2x4s and paper products, said John Talberth, executive director of the National Forest Protection Alliance and president of the Forest Conservation Council and principal author of the report. There are consistently more jobs, more income, and more public revenues associated with forest protection. Yet using economic analysis techniques from the Dark Ages, the Forest Service considers our national forests economically worthless unless they're logged, he said. The report, co-sponsored by the National Forest Protection Alliance and the Forest Conservation Council, also addresses what economists call externalities, which are costs passed on to businesses, communities, and individuals when national forests are logged. These include costs incurred by municipal water providers when rivers are polluted by logging sediments, as well as lost jobs and revenues incurred by businesses that support recreation and tourism. These costs are ignored by the U.S. Forest Service accounting systems, which only address the direct financial costs of the logging program, the group say. These costs include timber industry subsidies, which in a 1998 report by the U.S. General Accounting Office estimated cost American taxpayers at least $1.7 billion, with a B, over a three-year period from 1995 to 1998. These financial losses are just the tip of the iceberg, says Karen Moskowitz, a natural resource economist and co-author of the report. The costs associated with polluted water, increased floods, lost recreational opportunities, and degraded scenery are many times that amount. National forests and their watersheds purify water by moderating stream temperatures, filtering sediments and pollutants, and supplying nutrients needed by aquatic and terrestrial ecosystems. According to the report, national forests in the U.S. supply more than 530 million acre-feet of clear water each year to municipalities, businesses, and rural residents. Economists estimate that the value of this water for consumptive purposes alone is more than $3.7 billion per year. The U.S. Forest Service says this figure does not include the value of maintaining wild fish species, recreation, or the cost savings to municipalities who have reduced filtration costs because water from national forests is so clean. Watershed restoration is increasingly a U.S. Forest Service priority. The Forest Service fiscal 2000 budget will invest an additional $11.8 million to help restore 12 large watersheds nationwide. The additional funding supplements about $6.7 million from local Forest Service funds and up to an additional $18 million from partner organizations. The total investment in the 12 watershed restoration projects will be about $36 million in fiscal year 2000. Recreation, hunting, and fishing in national forests contribute at least $111 billion with a B to the gross domestic product each year and generate 2.9 million jobs a year. These uses contribute 31.4 times more value to the economy and generate 38 times more jobs than the timber sales program, the report said. On 5 national forests in the southern Rocky Mountains, for example, recreation values in 1996 was $1 billion with a B, almost 250 times the value of logging those same forests. And logging increases the wildfire risk, many ecologists believe. The Sierra Nevada Ecosystem Project's 1996 report states that timber harvest, through its effects on forest structure, local microclimate, and fuels accumulation, has increased fire severity more than any other recent human activity. In 1994, the Forest Service spent almost $1 billion, with a B, for fire management on national forest lands. The American Forest and Paper Association, the Forest Industry Association, whose members and contractors do much of the logging on the national forest, has a different viewpoint. Commenting on President Bill Clinton's February 1999 proposal to keep logging roads from invading 40 million roadless acres on national forests, Association President and CEO W. Henson Moore said, "The American people may be surprised to learn what the president is really doing is implementing a burn-and-rot policy on the national forests. Those are used to fight fires and help scientists control disease and insect infestations. They are also used by everyday Americans who want to enjoy themselves in the forest. The Forest Service already estimates they have 65 million acres of forest land at high risk of catastrophic wildfire and disease and insect infestation, and this new policy is going to make this situation even worse," Moore said. The agricultural industry benefits from the tens of thousands of wild pollinators, such as bees and birds, that use the national forest for habitat. In a 1997 study of ecosystem services, researchers estimated the potential contribution of wild pollinators to be between $4 billion and $7 billion a year. And forests help relieve global warming as well. America's national forests help absorb more than 53 million metric tons of carbon from the atmosphere each year, reducing the amount of carbon dioxide, a greenhouse gas, in the air. Economists estimate that this forest function alone is worth almost $3.4 billion a year. The U.S. Forest Service has estimated that industries looking for ways to offset the release of carbon dioxide from factories and power plants would be willing to pay about $65 per ton of carbon absorbed by forests, making trees more valuable as carbon sinks than as lumber. The economic report lends ammunition to efforts in Congress to end the federal timber sale subsidy program, says Representative Cynthia McKinney, a Georgia Democrat. The report illustrates that the commercial logging program is causing widespread economic harm to communities near our national forests, said McKinney. When this harm is added to the amount of money lost on the program each year, it becomes perfectly clear that the federal logging program is economically indefensible. McKinney is the sponsor of the National Forest Protection and Restoration Act, a bill before Congress that would end the federal timber sale program while putting people back to work restoring the damage caused by over 100 years of national forest logging. That bill now has 76 co-sponsors. It's a common-sense alternative is to protect Americans' national forests from commercial logging by reinvesting the logging subsidies into economically viable programs, McKinney said. Rather than spending taxpayer dollars to degrade our national heritage, we should invest in programs for ecological restoration, adequate school funding, alternative fiber research like hemp, vocational training, and community economic development. And that's today's commentary on Earth First Radio. Let's get back into animal news here. The Sea Shepherd Conservation Society is investigating the mass strandings of whales in the Bahamas in mid-March. Some 17 whales and dolphins were stranded, representing several different species and orders of cetaceans. A number of conservation groups have linked the whale stranding to weapons tests by the U.S. Navy, which was in the area to test its littoral warfare advanced development system. The Sea Shepherd says it has learned that there was more involved in the mass stranding than has been disclosed. The group is evaluating information received from government sources and says the Navy was not the only military presence in the area at the time, and the LWAD sonar tests were not the sole cause of the stranding. Four different species do not strand simultaneously due to a chance or natural causes, said Captain Bill Watson, president of Sea Shepherd. We will work with our membership and other non-government organizations to bring pressure to bear on the officials responsible for enforcement of the federal environmental laws and oversight of the National Marine Fisheries Service and military activities. Sea Shepherd Society will be filing comprehensive Freedom of Information Act requests to produce the evidence to compel the Navy to disclose the circumstances surrounding the incident. The Navy intends to resume the sea tests in May. For the Navy to proceed with the next phase of testing based on an obviously deficient environmental assessment would be illegal under the Marine Mammal Protection Act and the Endangered Species Act, according to Lanny Sinkin, the attorney representing Sea Shepherd and nine co-plaintiffs in a lawsuit over the Navy's deployment of low-frequency active sonar, a submarine detection system that environmentalists fear could harm sea life and even humans. Formal consultation with the National Marine Fisheries Service and permits are now obviously required under the Act. And the Fund for Animals recently testified against a new plan that would allow sport hunters and commercial trappers to kill bobcats in Pennsylvania. Bobcats have been protected for 30 years in Pennsylvania, but the Pennsylvania Game Commission is considering issuing permits for bobcats to be killed. The Game Commission has voted on the proposal to issue 290 bobcat permits to hunters and trappers in North and North Central Pennsylvania from October 2000 to February 2001. The Game Commission estimates that 3,000 bobcats inhabit Pennsylvania, although no recent population study has been completed. Without concrete population studies, the Game Commission is risking making the current bobcat population inviable, the Fund for Animals argues. The Game Commission has no idea how many bobcats there are in Pennsylvania, so they want to kill them in order to count them. It's a good thing these people are not in charge of the U.S. Census Bureau, said Diana Norris, grassroots coordinator for the Fund for Animals, who testified at the hearing. Bobcats are not overpopulated, and there is no management need for predator control, so the proposal is the result of desires of some hunters and trappers for bobcat pelts, the Fund for Animals said. Game Commission officials are already claiming that the bobcat season is a done deal, even though they have received hundreds of letters from Pennsylvania citizens opposing the proposal. According to Heidi Prescott, National Director of the Fund for Animals, why are they going through with the pretense of a public meeting if they're not planning to listen to the public? Well, Uncle Dennis knows why that is. A federal judge has ruled that the Department of Commerce improperly concluded that changing tuna import standards would not harm dolphins. The decision by U.S. Federal District Judge Felton Henderson overturns Commerce Secretary William Daley's decision to change the definition of dolphin-safe tuna to include tuna caught using encirclement nets. Environmental groups have charged that those nets can harass, injure, or kill dolphins. The case was brought by the Humane Society of the United States, Earth Island Institute, environmental activist David Brower, and other environmental organizations. The regulations changing the Dolphin Safe label were set to go into effect April 11th. The Commerce Department said last year that it lacked evidence that the nets harmed dolphins. Based on that decision and under the International Dolphin Conservation Program Act of 1997, the agency opted to allow encirclement-caught tuna to be labeled dolphin-safe as long as independent observers on the boats verified that no dolphins had been harmed. Henderson ruled the 1997 law requires studies of the effects on dolphins had been repeatedly caught by the nets and released, tests the agency did not complete. A decision to change the label without the benefit of any results from the critical stress research projects cannot be squared with Congress's clear intent, Henderson wrote. Secretary Daley flouted the law that was the result of a compromise between those who wanted open U.S. markets to dolphin-deadly tuna and dolphin protection advocates, said HSUS Executive Vice President Patricia Forkin. The law relied on the secretary to make an objective decision based on the best available scientific evidence. We're pleased that the court agreed that Secretary Daley did not live up to his end of the bargain, but Mexico said last Wednesday it will fight the ruling by a U.S. judge blocking the U.S. Department of Commerce from loosening the standards under which tuna can be labeled dolphin safe. Environment and Fisheries Minister Julia Carabias said the decision by U.S. District Judge Felton Henderson amounted to a trade protectionism, and the government will seek talks with Washington in order to safeguard its exports by Mexican fishermen. We're not going to rest until we've definitely resolved this embargo that has been such an unfair process for Mexico and Latin American countries, Carabias told the nation's number one broadcaster, Televisa. Henderson's decision blocked the Commerce Department from allowing the use of dolphin-safe labels on tuna caught by purse seine nets, huge encircling nets used in the eastern Pacific to catch yellowfin tuna swimming below the dolphins. And Mexican Trade Minister Hermenino Blanco said one had to draw a distinction between the U.S. government's stance and a ruling by an independent judge. Blanco said some of the environmental groups that lodged the lawsuit had quite dark interests. The main tuna exporters in Latin America are Mexico, Colombia, Ecuador, Costa Rica, Nicaragua, Panama, and Venezuela, most of which employ purse seine nets. And a Florida fisherman and owner of his fishing vessel have been fined $15,000 for violating the South Atlantic shrimp fishery regulations. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has charged Thomas Berry, operator of the fishing vessel Dixie Hartel, and the vessel's owner Miss Courtney Incorporated, for fishing for rock shrimp in an area closed to shrimping and for failing to have a certified bycatch reduction device installed in each net that was rigged for fishing. Miss Courtney Incorporated is also under a 30-day ban on fishing for or dealing in federally regulated species of fish for which a federal permit is required. In January, the U.S. Coast Guard aircraft sighted the Dixie Hartel trawling in an area off of Vero Beach, Florida, that was closed to rock shrimping. With the support of a U.S. Coast Guard vessel, NOAA Fisheries Enforcement Special Agents boarded the vessel and discovered 2,962 pounds of rock shrimp and 5,600 pounds of panade shrimp in the vessel's hold. The agent seized the shrimp, which NOAA later sold for $30,000. NOAA is seeking legal permission to seize those proceeds. NOAA will aggressively investigate and prosecute illegal fishing activities. One of our most important missions is to enforce the laws that are intended to protect our precious marine resources so that we and future generations can continue to enjoy the sea's bounty, said Senior Enforcement Attorney Karen Antrim Rain of NOAA's Office of General Counsel. And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has launched efforts to reduce the deaths of seabirds, including the endangered short-tailed albatross that are caught in fishing lines. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Pacific States Marine Fisheries Commission have signed an agreement providing $400,000 to help longline fishermen install seabird deterrent devices on boats fishing the Bering Sea and the North Pacific off the coast of Alaska. Unfortunately, the short-tailed albatross and many other seabirds have developed the habit of following commercial longline fishing boats and diving on baited hooks, often with deadly results. This unique partnership addresses this problem without disrupting Alaska's vital fisheries industry, said U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Director Jamie Rappaport-Clark. With the support of the administration and Congress, we've established a landowner incentive program to provide on-the-ground dollars to people to further the conservation of endangered species. That program made today's agreement possible. And the National Marine Fisheries Service wants to track and monitor the trade of Patagonian and Antarctic toothfish to better protect it from being exploited, the agency announced today. They were talking about Chilean sea bass here. Much of the fishing for toothfish is managed internationally by the Commission for the Conservation of Antarctic Marine Living Resources, an organization charged with conserving marine life in the southern oceans. Officials at the National Marine Fisheries Service say that during the 1990s, restaurants and markets in the U.S. began to sell toothfish under the name Chilean sea bass. Within a few years, toothfish became a popular restaurant dish. Despite increased inspections and sanction in recent years, toothfish landings have been estimated to be at up to twice that specified by the treaty. Consumers need to know that the fish that finds its way to market is either Patagonian or Antarctic toothfish and is harvested through the Southern Ocean both legally and illegally, said Gary Matlock, director of the National Marine Fisheries Service's Sustainable Fisheries Office. The rate at which this resource is being exploited is alarming and unsustainable. The scale of illegal, unregulated, and unreporting fishing for toothfish is a very serious conservation and management concern. Under the proposed rule, every toothfish shipment to the U.S. would require proper documentation on the size and location of the catch, as well as the name and national registry of the fishing vessel. The rule would require permits for dealers to import, export, or transship toothfish. If you want to look at the proposed rule, it's available at www.nmfs.gov/trade. Two Milford, Delaware men were found guilty of illegal horseshoe crabbing. Jay Donovan and Larry Bass were convicted of misdemeanor violations of the Lacey Act and conspiracy to violate the Lacey Act, a federal law prohibiting interstate transportation of wildlife taken in violation of a state law. In the two-day trial, Donovan and Bass both held limited licenses to collect horseshoe crabs, but not to transport the crabs across state lines. The men were observed collecting crabs in Delaware in violation of their permits and then selling them in Virginia. When they were sentenced in June, each of the men could face up to 1 year in prison, a $100,000 fine, and forfeiture of vehicles involved in the crime. Horseshoe crabs have significant ecological, economic, and scientific importance. The states of Maryland, New Jersey, and Delaware have passed legislation to curb horseshoe crab fisheries, spurred by a one-third drop in the number of spawning crabs since 1991. In Delaware and other eastern states, horseshoe crab eggs are a primary food source for migratory shorebirds. Delaware is one of the largest stopover areas for shorebirds in North America, with an estimated 1.5 million shorebirds passing through each spring. As the crabs deposit their eggs, the birds gorge themselves on this critical energy source to fuel their journey from South America to the Arctic. The pharmaceutical industry uses horseshoe crab blood to develop medicines. Several regional fisheries, primarily eel and conch, use horseshoe crabs for bait. And the legal sport of hunting grizzly bears in the Great Bear Rainforest of British Columbia has resumed with the full sanction of the British Columbian government. Despite overwhelming evidence that the legal sport hunting of these threatened animals should be stopped, bear biologists have asserted the coastal grizzly populations are being seriously impacted by hunting overkill. In December, 68 professional biologists submitted a petition to the BC government calling for a 5 to 10 year moratorium on all grizzly bear hunting pending completion of a long-term population studies in the province's 6 bioregions. And this week, government biologist Dionysus Delu revealed that his research shows that the Ministry of Environment is allowing 200% more grizzlies to be killed than its sustainable harvest rate would permit. Delu was suspended without pay for his efforts to bring this critical information to the attention of his colleagues in the Ministry of the Environment. And a new U.S. Geological Service research project shows that rural areas and farms may be friendlier to frogs and toads than urban areas. Dr. Melinda Knutson, a conservation scientist with the U.S. Geological Survey, said the research on frog and toad populations in two Midwestern states shows that frog and toad abundance and species richness were low in urban areas, but near normal in agricultural areas. Despite some risks, Midwestern frog populations seem to coexist with agriculture, the dominant land use in the region, Newson explained. Amphibian populations in intensive row crop agriculture are dependent upon adjacent, less disturbed environments such as forests, grasslands, emergent wetlands, lakes, and streams. Even small areas of these other cover types may be important in maintaining amphibian populations on the landscape. And stopping declines in amphibia populations has become a national priority. Before critical habitat can be retained or restored, quality amphibian habitat must be defined. Scientists with the USGS are examining how various landscapes such as wetlands and agricultural areas relate to frog and toad populations. And their research may benefit natural resource managers who have been given the task of promoting healthy and diverse amphibian populations. And evidence shows amphibians have been in decline globally for the last half century. Over the past 40 years, the researchers say a decline has averaged 4 to 5% annually, with some especially steep falls in the 1960s. After a rapidly shrinking then, the rate of population decline has eased off, though it is still continuing. The researchers say their findings support the widespread impression of amphibian decline, which has until now been largely based on anecdotal evidence. The research team, whose work is reported in the science magazine Nature, was led by Jeff Houlihan of the University of Ottawa in Canada, also included scientists from Switzerland and Russia. They used data from 936 separate amphibian populations and unpublished data from herpetologists around the world. The team says this was to avoid relying on evidence that was either anecdotal or derived from short-term studies at small geographical scales. It notes the persistent reports of catastrophic amphibian population crashes in Australia, South and Central America, and in high-altitude parts of the western United States. These reports have suggested local climate changes, acid rain disease, increased solar radiation, or a combination of several of these as probable causes, but the most documented are the disappearance of amphibians from small regions, making extrapolations to the global scale difficult. That's about all the time we have for news tonight on Earth First Radio. If you'd like to get news or announcements from your bioregion to Earth First Radio, send us email at cruzef@cruzio.com. That's cruzef@cruzio.com. Or you can send letters to Earth First Radio at P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California 95061. Our address again, Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California 95061, and be sure to send those announcements at least 3 weeks in advance. If you'd like more in-depth information and news about the Earth First movement, please subscribe to the Earth First Journal. Their address is P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon 97440. Once again, the Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon 97440, and your first issue is free. You can listen to Earth First Radio on your computer on the World Wide Web at www.radioforall.net. That's www.radio, followed by the number 4, all.net. You'll need a sound card in your computer, but the software you need to play the MP3 files is free on the website. And just out, Free Radio Santa Cruz is now streaming live audio, so if you want to listen in on your computer on Thursday nights at 8 o'clock Pacific Daylight Time, go to www.microradio.net/FRSC and follow the links to Radio Destiny. Earth First Radio is carried on a growing number of free speech and non-commercial radio stations. Want to welcome especially the listeners at WXXE in Syracuse, New York. on Saturday night, please ask your local station to broadcast Earth First Radio. Earth First Radio is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Our theme music was written and performed by Daryl Cherney off the CD Keep It Wild. I'm Uncle Dennis, and thank you for listening to Earth First Radio. Now we're going to head out of here with some Casey Neal. This one's called Riff Raff.
Living for the music.